This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Travis Hugh Cully is an author and a playwright. He holds an MFA in writing from the Art Institute of Chicago, which is remarkable, since Cully was illiterate until about age 17. Mildly dyslexic and labeled a discipline problem, Cully slipped through the cracks of his Miami school. His frustrated parents struggled to understand him. He was bullied by his older brother and beaten by his father. Cully's problems escalated after he was sexually molested by a pastor at summer camp. He would ultimately be saved by a few teachers, the theater, writing, and his desire to understand his own situation. Cully is the author of two books. His latest is titled A Comedy and a Tragedy, a memoir of learning how to read and write. He joins us by phone from his home in Colorado. Travis Hugh Cully, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. The honesty that you express about your experiences, your thoughts, and your family are admirable, and so much of it is troubling. Why did you want to write this book?
I took a real brave dive. I felt like I jumped right off of a cliff of sorts. I said, I need to write the story of how I came to read and write. I need to tell the story of how I developed literacy. And I've been working on that book, that story, ever since. The past 14 years have been dedicated essentially to completing the story. In 2005, when I complete my graduate degree in writing from the School of the Art Institute, I go to Finland for the purpose of writing about an art festival that takes place there every year. And it's in that context, already in the development of stages of the book, that I had this remarkable conversation with Annetta Sklenko. She, at the time, was a student in Finland studying English philology. In our conversation, she asked me, how do you become literate? And I take the time to try and answer her question with this book, trying to essentially say how I came to reading and writing, which is different than how most students and most people, I think, in the world will come to reading and writing. So I believe the book already puts something in front of students as a subject to say, this is about your process of uncovering the meaning of the world. This is about how we collect and gather information. But in another way, it comes with a warning that says, my experience is probably not like what your experience was. And maybe you can learn from my experience.
So the book takes 14 years to write. I'm guessing it was a painful process.
Yes, I suppose. That held me back a lot, trying to tell this story truthfully with the tone of having succeeded, having survived. It felt a bit Sisyphean, pardon the mythological reference, but I felt many times going in that I would not be understood. And so I wrestled considerably with the question of whether or not I was ready to write the book, whether or not people were ready to receive the meaning in this book. And I suppose that's why it's necessary that the book is complete, because this was the book I had to write. And I don't think it was a choice. I think I simply had to write it in order to untangle this question of in whose hands does meaning reside. We in society say that students are on a grade scale, an F, a D, a C, a B, or an A. Society is much more complicated than A through F. And we have to look at the dialectical relationship that's at stake in education, because students see society as well and judge, wait, that's a dangerous place. Other students say, my home is a dangerous place. And society looks like it's welcoming. What I tried to do in this memoir is open up that dialectical relationship, which says, okay, what's at stake for the student who has to enter into society? It opens up, I hope, the question of the real meaning of education, because I think that's something that still needs to be discussed. I think it's a critical point in our world and in our society that has to be raised as a thing in crisis.
So I think most of us feel that there are issues that should be addressed in the school system. And I know you were a bright, clever, and talented kid. You say you were basically illiterate until you were about 17. Were you really clever enough to fool the system? Or did your teachers just not care? Was it a combination? What I'm getting at is how did this happen?
Well, I guess that's what I'm trying to illustrate in a roundabout way, that society doesn't necessarily see kids, and yet society says that they can teach kids to see society. And I felt I was not read or not received. I felt like there was a larger field of illiteracy around me. I could easily fool the systems that were educating me at that time, because I could see what the receptors and where the sensors were. I could fake my way through it. I became a very good actor, and at times I learned, I just need to look at the page. If I look at the page and do what my teacher tells me, make my eyes go back and forth, then the teacher will walk past me, and I will, for another moment, be allowed to continue my charade that says that I can read and write. While I pretend to, it doesn't mean I authentically can. And so I think my story raises a critical question about whether or not the school system has the sensitivity to know what it's doing at the interior level of the life of their students, to see whether or not their students are getting to the graduate level or getting to graduation even with the ability to read and write. In my early experience, I can't say that was happening, that my teachers were seeing me that closely. After middle school, when I went into New World School of the Arts, there's a shift in the book. It's as though I meet a hero. New World School of the Arts is a completely different school. It's also based in the public school system of Dade County, but it's organized differently. It's a magnet program that trains for different talents, and it has a different pedagogical opinion. Let's say it has a different philosophy about education. And at New World School of the Arts, I felt enabled to start working with language differently. The more difficult aspects of the federal public school system are less observable to me. I find my way into the most prestigious, most liberal, freest art school in the country at the time. So my story is a litmus test, in a sense, looking at these different modes of education and how they work for me at different points in my life. Early on, there was great resistance. I learned to distrust the teachers. I learned to cover up my work. I learned to cheat and find ways of getting an A in my test without having done any of the homework. I was able to learn the codes and bring the codes to class. I became very sophisticated at tricking the system. But when I got into an arts program where those same skills were sought for, I accelerated. Mm-hmm. Suddenly I could act, and I could present myself, and I could use language in an expressive way. And that it made me feel passionate, and it made me connected to my students, because at the time my family life was falling apart. And so, in essence, theater, the same skills that I used to trick my third grade teacher, Miss Helene, those same skills were harnessed and became successful in my life between 10th, 11th, and 12th grades inside of New World School of the Arts and underneath the supervision of a teacher, Richard Paul Gennaro. If it wasn't for Richard Paul Gennaro, I could say my education would never come to a point of culmination as it has here. The arts would never have been able to find me and come to save my life. And essentially, that's what happens in my book.
And we should say Richard Gennaro is one of the founders of the New World School of the Arts.
He was the architect of the theater department. When I first enter into that theater department, I have a connection with Richard Gennaro, who sees this child has some different skills to him, has a reputation of being disobedient in the classroom, of having a short attention span, of thinking in abstract and aberrant ways. And he took a focus to that and was able to open up for me an understanding of myself, probably because he just comes from the position of alternative education and was able to identify where true creativity lurked in a place that could be misunderstood. It's different from teaching skills in math or in science, measurable, you know, quantifiable aptitudes and things like that. In the theater, you have a success rate that grows not by a student's willingness to crunch numbers and to pressurize their intelligence, but that a student grows in their ability to be relaxed in themselves and their ability to reveal who they are. I think one larger question that the book brings up is that 1 in 5 children in schools, this is a quote from a number of different sources basically combined, are affected by childhood trauma, childhood sexual assault of some sort. And that's an awfully big number. And when we look at a classroom of kids and see, and the teacher looks at that new classroom of kids on day one and says, okay, let's try and treat everyone equally. Let's try and teach everyone the lesson. They don't do the work of breaking down, okay, 20% of this classroom, in essence, could teach something to the other 80% of the classroom. 20% of the classroom has experience coming in that 80% of the classroom may not have. And that's what my book, I hope, teases out, is the complex between trauma and creativity.
Right, and I think you say this very well in the book when you say it's no secret that there is a relationship between children's performance in school and the hardships they are expected to live at home. And at the same time, teachers, as you just pointed out, are expected to teach those kids not knowing what's happening to them at home. And kids become pretty adept at hiding what's going on inside, as you did. Is there something we can learn from your experience?
I hope so. I'd like to say to you that teachers need to anticipate for stories like mine to appear in the classroom. They need to anticipate that traumas like mine are ordinary. That if one in five students are affected like I am, then that's one student in every aisle. And teachers need to really be prepared for that. Secondly, and this is not an education point to the particular place of language or language arts, but to the overall organization of schools, I guess I don't really write the book from the standpoint of let's reform schools in lots of ways. There are many people who have written extensive works on how should we reform schools, and I appreciate those books. But what I'm really doing in this one is saying what my experience was. And if I were to advocate anything, I'd say that the onus is really the responsibility sits with the student to excel, no matter the context. But
I want to say this is Travis Hugh Cully. He's an author and a playwright. He's written two books, The Immortal Class, and this latest one called A Comedy in a Tragedy, a memoir of learning how to read and write. Did you have something more to add?
I did have something quick to add. What I'd say is that if there's another realm for pedagogical development, if I could reform schools in one little way, I would say that we have a responsibility to turn around how we teach sexual education. And that, I think, would help a great deal in the classroom. I think that we need to stop teaching students at the level of how to have sex safely or unsafely, because that puts kids in a difficult position of responsibility. We need to start that conversation much earlier and start that conversation around sexual safety. How do we create spaces that are gender neutral? Mm-hmm. That is, I think, the more important missing piece in the educational picture. If we could build on sexual safety, I think we'd be able to learn at a much higher and faster rate with a different level of absorption for students to be able to see, oh, I've really gained something. I see the distance between myself and another. And I think if that part of the educational picture is left out, we're missing a big part, a part that will always have to return. And that if we miss the relationship between the student and their neighbor as being essential, they don't uncover that situation again until they're studying philosophy or psychology.
Well, let's go back to your home life for a second, because as you point out in the book, both of your parents were educated with master's degrees, your mother in social work. Why do you think they didn't look into getting you more help with reading, which may have at that point uncovered your dyslexia?
I really believe that they didn't want that to be going on. I think there's a subjectivity that marred the methodology in what they learned. And in terms of my mother's training in as a healthcare professional, as a master of handling people in crisis, I think that even though she earned those skills in school, she was blinded by the possibility of trauma affecting her own personal life that closely. And I think she was just unprepared.
Well, and maybe a little understandable. I want to talk a little bit about your family. They don't sound like they started out where they ended up, which I know none of us do. In other words, your father didn't always hit you, and your mother, who tried to have you hospitalized at one point, wasn't always unsupportive. Do I have that right?
No, that's true. Yeah, they did their best, I suppose. My parents did their best in some way, but their best was fairly insubstantial for me. Because at the point in which their own World of Illusions fell apart, it was like the whole game was off, you know? They couldn't ever explain, like, well, this is why we had to give you the fable of the Tooth Fairy. This is why. Now, can you forgive me and we can move through it? No, it was like once I realized that there was an illusion between me and them, my distrust of them was pretty amplified, I suppose. And because I had experienced a significant betrayal at camp, I became pretty susceptible to betrayal at home. And I think also it's worth noting that after that trauma which took place, that my father and my brother learned that they could take advantages with me, and they were very subtle. And so perhaps while you can say they were not always horrible, in some ways they were regularly, ritualistically, ceremonially difficult. And I always had to put up with the feeling of humiliation and danger with my father and my brother. And I always had to put up with a feeling of shame and disappointment with my mother. While there were moments, few perhaps, that were critical, and maybe I write about a few of those, throughout, the tenor of our relationship was one of distrust, not one of togetherness. Never did I have the feeling that I could freely express myself. After I came home from camp, and this digs, I guess, into the book, but...
This is the camp, I just want to clarify, that your father had gone to when he was a kid. It was a summer church camp, and he had a pretty good experience there growing up and wanted you and your brother to experience the same thing. This is where the unfortunate experience of you being molested by a pastor occurred. And when you came home, you did what a lot of victims do. You suffered in silence.
Well, when I come home, I just identify with everybody differently, but my parents don't notice any difference. There's no visible difference. My behavior seems the same. But I connect with my next-door neighbor, Melanie Ortiz, who's younger by 1 year. She and her sister are kind of just a different sort. And when I meet Melanie, she's wearing different colored sneakers, and she's dressed in this kind of Punky Brewster era, kind of like every color on every arm, you know, and I found her to be fascinating because she had this freedom to express herself. I started to exhibit along those same lines, and my parents suppressed those creative decisions that I made. So I came home from Melanie's house with different colored socks and different colored shoes and my hair spiked, and my parents put the kibosh on that, and they judged me for that, and they laughed at me for those kind of strides of creativity. And I found myself always having to express through a level of resistance that my family held that said, you're not supposed to express yourself. You're not supposed to feel things. You're not supposed to go through stuff. And I was trying to, you know, behind the scenes, what they could not tell was that I was experiencing unquantifiable trauma, and I was experiencing unquantifiable ambiguity and anxiety about my relationships to people, and they did not understand the process I was going through at all. So I was kind of called the dunce or the fool or I was the canary, essentially, to test whether or not a place was safe. Everyone, my brother, my father, and my mother, there was just this way in which they said, well, Travis is afraid of nothing. We can't really contain his behavior. He's a bit of a wild child. All they could do is try and restrain me at every basic level that they could until I had to leave the house completely. And I should say this responsibly, 3 out of 4 children who are homeless, that is to say minors who are homeless or experience homelessness, they are affected by childhood sexual assault. That 75% of homeless minors experience sexual assault at home. I had not experienced at home this abuse, but at camp I experienced another kind of abuse at home. And yet my home was not a comfortable place for me. And I ultimately had to leave there in order to be able to express myself comfortably.
This is Travis Hugh Cully. He's an author and playwright, and we're talking about his latest book, A Comedy and a Tragedy. It's a memoir of how he learned to read and write. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. We'll be right back. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. I'm talking with author and playwright Travis Hugh Cully. He grew up in Miami, Florida, and was basically illiterate until about the age of 17. He was mildly dyslexic, had problems at school and at home. Cully's problems escalated after he was sexually molested by a pastor at summer camp. He's written this memoir just out called A Comedy and a Tragedy about how he learned to read and write. Travis, before the break, you were saying that home was not a comfortable place for you and you ended up having to leave. This is when you were in high school, and at that point, things had really escalated. Your parents ended up divorced, and you were complicated. You were rebellious. You didn't do what you were asked to do in school. In many ways, you could understand the frustration your parents must have felt. It sounds like your mother struggled to understand you. So you left, ended up living in your car, and never stopped going to school, even though you were living in your car. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, happily. That's a really crucial moment, I think, in my education, where I had learned that I could trust my teachers, not my parents. In the beginning of the book, I open with this Rousseau quote about the dangers of lying to children, that when you're in the position of lying to children, you might learn the danger of children lying to men. I learned that the school system was teaching me more truthfully than my home system was. I came home from art school, and I came home to a sterile environment that didn't have any true concern about how I was at all. And so I ultimately had to choose school over family. And that's an unusual position to be in, I suppose. Most young people, when they leave home, they also leave school. They leave the structure of society at large. And the thing that saved me was that I found my family and next support group to be in my school environment, which was a theater environment. Lucky me. I could then sit down with a script and be surrounded by friends who were my age, and they took on themselves the role of my brother or my sister or my father or my mother. And lucky me, I got to go through plays with this cast, always transforming those relationships, in a sense, on my own, through the apparatus of the theater, as opposed to through the natural home life I should have maybe had.
Since we're on the topic of school, I want to talk about your teachers for a minute. One of your teachers said something that was pretty profound about why it was important to learn to read and write. He told you that people needed to be able to hear from you and that you had to possess the ability to explain your sometimes complicated thoughts. He said you needed to be literate so that there was no confusion about who you are, what you want, or where you are supposed to be going. And if you couldn't do that, you would find that other people would become more and more unable to help you. What was your reaction to hearing your teacher say that to you?
Oh, it was surprising, because what he was pointing to was something very truthful. As a theater teacher, he could have said, well, let's look at all these plays, and let's look at all these novels, and let's look at all these great characters. Let's look at all the things we can do with prose. Instead, he says, you need to learn how to read and write so that you can prove who you are to the people who are going to test you. You need to be able to have your documents together so that when someone knocks at your door, you're able to prove that you're the right person behind the door. You need to have your access to language at hand, because your thoughts are so unusual and different that we have to be able to learn from you. He sees the classroom turn around at that point and says, okay, there's some information in this student, and we have to sit back and give it the right environment, and that student will express to us what we need to know. And so he gives to me this definition of literacy that's very basic and very practical. It says, essentially, I need to have custody over the who I am question. And the moment that I do have custody over the who I am question, then the process is mine, and I take things up from there. I am glad you bring this moment into the fore picture here, because this is really, I think, a brave moment, even for a teacher who's got their own responsibilities and to guide me in one direction. He steps right through the veil of reality and says, don't believe all this theater stuff. You need to learn language, because you need to know that you're in the right room at the right time when you're supposed to be.
This was a big turning point for you, but there was also another one. And this one is when you were able to read all the words on the page, reciting a poem. Can you talk about that?
Auditioning for Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, I had prepared a monologue, Shakespeare, and it rhymed and it had helped me, and I was ready to go ahead with my performance, and the director hands me a poem instead and says, read this. So my slate was completely clear at that point, and I was handed the Jabberwocky. And the Jabberwocky is such a poem that it continues to frustrate your expectations. So every word that I thought I wouldn't know, it turned out I didn't know, but I could sense that the author was playing with the letters somehow. And if I read with that kind of intention, I found the words of the poem coming right out of my mouth, and they surprised me because I didn't have any anticipation of what they'd sound like. And so that director happened to put me in front of the light just in the right way so that when I turned my head and saw my profile, I realized, wait a second, at a basic alphabetic level, at a phonic level, I could read. I could put the right sounds to these symbols. And it shocked me. It came with a big reward. For me personally, I was given the part of Lewis Carroll. I became the the actor in the position of reading Lewis Carroll's lines, and or, you know, the kind of narrative backdrop of the play. And to me, I thought that was awfully ironic to have gone such a distance, you know, resisting literacy, to then step immediately into the shoes of Lewis Carroll. And I think if I had not done that, I would not have the confidence that I have today to tell my story the way that I am. It's not a popular story to tell when you're a boy about how your world can be turned upside down.
Often when people go through trauma, as a way of protecting themselves, they block things out. Conversations, chunks of time, incidents, and I guess that's a coping mechanism. You seem to have a remarkable memory for detail. What do you attribute that to?
Well, strangely, my answer is trauma. Yes, there is that detail that says that there is the phenomenon of recovered memory. In my experience, what happened to me happened at such an early point that I was not even aware of what could have happened to me. It was as though I had to grow up past that point to even understand the nature of what took place. I don't know if you can grasp that. That kind of recovered memory is one that really lurks in your heart. It's the heart of ineffability. It's what one can never point one's finger at and is everywhere at the same time. However, another effect of trauma is that it turns on the lights. While it separates experiences, it also forces the psyche of the traumatized mind to gather the pieces of their new world, to recalibrate. And so I think some of the details, and maybe the fact that I have a sense for details, comes from, it's a big disclosure, but a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder that continues in my mind to iterate what these details were, to remind myself of the real experience that I'm going through with that detail.
This is Travis Hugh Cully. He's an author and a playwright, and he's written two books, The Immortal Class and this latest one, A Comedy and a Tragedy. It's a memoir about how he taught himself to read and write. Travis, I know we talked a little bit about your family. Can you talk about your relationship with them now?
Fairly distant. I hope they've gotten the opportunity to take a look at the book, and authentically, I'm interested in what they read. I've written the book as an effort to pull together my family, to incorporate everyone, because it seemed from my standpoint I'm the only one pulling my family together. Each person is kind of in this individual position saying, no, I don't want to participate. And I'm the only knot, if you would, if I could use that metaphor, that'll draw everyone together. So I'm proud of myself for what I've done because I hope I get to pull my family together in a different and deeper way. It's been a difficult path, and it's not one that's come to a conclusion. So I look forward to my family uniting around this and finding it important. I know that might seem difficult for each of them personally, but I hope they're able to look past the challenge of that because I wrote this book for them and for everyone around them. Because they're not so unusual that other people cannot learn from what happened in our lives. So I hope to follow the teaching of Martin Buber, which says, make yourself a teaching, make your life a teaching. Good or bad, right or wrong, for better or for worse, essentially, make yourself the best example you can. And people will make the best they can from that.
There aren't many parents that can look back without cringing about how they've handled certain issues or events with their children. And most parents, I think, are just doing the best they can, as you pointed out earlier. Kids don't always share everything, and parents aren't always sure what to look for. What advice would you give parents if they had a kid like you?
I think that children need to be listened to and need to be told the truth. The writing is more important than the reading. I believe that. I believe that also that the listening is more important than the speaking. They seem paradoxical. The bias is not on expression or on impression, but it's a matter of the respect of the person. And that's difficult in our society. Our society is convoluted with deceptions of many sorts.
If you had to boil it down, what do you want people to take away from your book?
I hope that people check their own literacy from the book and test their own literacy by the book. I hope that this culture that assumes and accepts itself as literate and as educated, I hope that for the sake of those who cannot afford that standing, that each person with that standing take a deeper investigation of what it means, that we don't assume what intelligence looks like, because the moment we do that, we stand to learn something. And so I hope that people are humbled to how it is that they really do encounter new meaning. I hope that many different conversations are opened up about the nature of our language and what does it mean to agree to signs and symbols, because it's important to know that just because we can agree upon the meaning of a sign, it doesn't mean that we agree upon the certitude of its purpose. You know, there's always a level in which we can agree, in which we can disagree. So I don't think we should fear the subject or fear the study of language, that we need to really deeply investigate it as the point of solidarity for all the people across our culture and our world. If I can say really what I want people to get from the book, internationally speaking, I want to say that America is not a monolinguistic society. It is a polyglottinous community in which we all have to learn each other's language. It really doesn't have to do with how well or how we did on the English test, if you understand my meaning.
Travis, what is your experience since you've come out with this book and this news? Because it is harder for males to come out and talk about being sexually molested.
It's painful, but I also want to say that it's impossible to do alone. The fact is that men experience this kind of abuse just as women do, just as girls have. And this trend will continue and we should be aware of the fact that it's not going to stop. Even if it's horrific to think about, in a specific or personal life, we have to be aware that this will happen again, and that it did not just happen to you. By raising my voice to what happened to me, I hope to give other victims and survivors just enough of a hold that says, you're not alone in this, because that's the first doorway, the first invitation to I think, surviving one's trauma is connecting with other survivors and moving on with your life without anything holding you back from understanding what happened. The trauma occurs, the information is given, you have the lesson with you, and you have to try and move forward with it. So I say, as a survivor, connecting with other survivors is a very good thing. And I also think that the community of survivors and survivorship should not be a hushed community. I'm not afraid of the fact that people are going to recognize that experience with me and connect that experience to me. I hope to make it easier for survivors to walk through their experience as they are. And it is not easy. It is scary. Anytime that you find that there's something you cannot talk about, that's scary. It creates a great deal of anxiety. But then the moment that you do talk about it, another kind of anxiety unfolds. And so you go from tragedy to comedy. And I hope that through this, I'll be able to laugh about my trauma with other people, identifying the difficulties and identifying the path of survivorship for each person. I could step back even further and say, on an aesthetic level, we should all be afraid of nothing. We should find that our first objective is to make it through the fearful experience, to make it through the catastrophe. And there's a moment in which you take the tragedy mask off and put the comedy mask on and say, okay, I can step over the big waves. I can step and make a light thing out of a heavy challenge. And I offer that as a tool of recovery for people. When you're immured in the difficulty of it, in the pain of it, to remember that it's real. And because it's real, it's not a story. And because it's not a story, you can laugh about it. It's happening to you. It's chosen you. And I find that to be a source for comedy. I know it seems a bit cynical, maybe, that I say, this chooses me, and there's nothing else I can do about it. If I can't laugh about it, it'll kill me.
Thank you for writing this book, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Travis Hugh Cully, he's the author of this book, A Comedy and a Tragedy, A Memoir of Learning How to Read and Write. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Next, we'll revisit a conversation Faith had about deliciously bad writing by accomplished authors. Thanks for listening.
I'm Faith Middleton. Join the conversation with us on Twitter at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR, where you'll find our lineup of interesting guests for the week. Now we're going to talk to Julia Scott, who's edited this book, Drivel, Deliciously Bad Writing by Your Favorite Authors. Julia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, in this book we have contributions from Dave Eggers, Amy Tan, Chuck. Am I saying this right? Is it Poloniuk?
It's Palahniuk.
Palahniuk. Thank you so much. I've wondered this forever. Rick Moody, Mary Roach, Gillian Flynn, A.J. Jacobs, and more. How'd you collect these?
Lots of extortion and knee breaking was involved. No, just kidding. you know, it's interesting. Some authors really got into the concept of a book that, as you said, sort of celebrates the stage before a person can give birth to their best work, and thought that it was hilarious that it would be presented as a humor book where the authors were in on the joke. And some authors I approached just got it right away and dove enthusiastically into their mounds and mounds of terrible early writing. In many cases, they had their mothers go and search through trunks and attics to find these precious gems from their childhood.
You know what's amazing? You know what's amazing, Julia, is that I feel such shame about different things that I have written in the past, you know, that are just, let's just call it not my best work, that I cannot even bear to open, you know, a diary and look at it. I'm just so mortified. And so I just think these people are so brave and terrific.
I feel the same way. It was so fun working with these folks, you know, and it's funny too, you know, you have these, you know, really, I mean, all of the authors are authors of note in this book, but many of them are best-selling authors, and you threw out some of the names, Dave Eggers, Amy Tan, Gillian Flynn,
yeah.
Gone Girl, now,
so,
you know, motion picture.
Yeah, so,
and they, you know, they, I think you'd think at a certain point they would sort of decide that they have too much to lose. By bringing their
yeah.
putrid, turgid writing gems out for the world to see. But actually, all of those people have taught writing at one time or another in some capacity. And they appreciate the value of inspiration.
Yeah, well, let's do a couple. I'm going to quote from some of these. This is Neil Pollack. He's author of 8 books of fiction and nonfiction. He did that Alternadad book, which was a bestseller on parenting. That it's a memoir, and so he's outing himself for a job application that he wrote in 1992. And this is what it sounds like. He kept this. This was to Tina Brown, okay, who was the editor of the New Yorker at the time. And he writes,
right.
and he says, "Dear Ms. Brown, I'll cut to the quick. I would like to work for The New Yorker. And I imagine with the big changeover, you may need lots of editorial help. So I'm throwing my hat into the ring and asking you to consider hiring me as an editorial assistant for your new project. I've been precociously reading The New Yorker for some time now, and I am a devotee of the current magazine as well as of its historical heritage. Most of the writers I respect most, living and dead, have written for your magazine at some time. I'm willing to cut my journalistic and literary teeth elsewhere if I can't get a job at The New Yorker, but I'm determined not to end up anywhere else. The resume I've enclosed doesn't indicate this, but I've been working as a freelance writer since graduating. 2 months ago, I've been doing pretty well, but I'm still waiting for the big score. Maybe you could help. I strongly encourage you to take a chance on me, but if I don't suit your needs at this time, thank you for reviewing my application. I look forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the second letter in that selection where he's written to the editor of a magazine that doesn't exist anymore, saying, I'm young and gutsy as a Marine in combat.
Right. That was Strobe Talbot, right? I think it was.
Yeah.
Here's one that you included in the book from Simon Rich, who's written for The New Yorker, and his books have been published in a dozen languages. And he dug up his, what were these from? Was this from his childhood, right? Did his mother write these down for him? Did he publish his own?
No, Simon is a former writer for SNL, and he's a humorist for The New Yorker now. And his contribution is one of the youngest, the hero is one of the youngest people. I think he was maybe 6 or 7 or something, very precocious when he wrote this family newspaper. He called it Simon's Newspaper. And he writes this very dry introduction about how the newspaper went under only after a couple of issues, but they gave it a good run. Basically, it was just an internal newsletter that he typed up and shared with his older brother Nathaniel Rich, who's also in this book, and his father Frank Rich, who's writes for the, you know, obviously he's the columnist for the New York Times, and talking about current events as if they were news, except that the current events are things happening in their household.
So here's one. It starts with and he's dictating these. I think it wasn't his mother writing them down, I think, but he's dictating. He says, "Note: I have a brother Nathaniel. He's 4 years older than me. I was very much on the Nathaniel beat." Topic, bubblegum. Nathaniel Rich blew a bubble that was almost as big as my face. I thought it was pretty good. It was the biggest bubble I ever saw. It was almost as big as the S on Superman's chest. I mean, bigger. So that's all for the top story today. Then a topic, rock and roll. Nathaniel likes rock and roll. He even watches MTV. He loves rock and roll so much that he even talks about it. In fact, he doesn't like it. He loves it. He likes it even more than baseball cards. That's it.
That's it.
Then advertisements. Here is a list of what you could get your child for Christmas. 1, G.I. Joe figures. 2, Police Academy. 3, Double Dare. 4, Ring Raiders. 5, some clothes. And then he reviews a few things. And his editorial is, I mean, he did editorials. Mikhail Gorbachev, he writes about, he says, Mikhail Gorbachev is a pretty good leader of France. He makes peace in the entire world. It's just absolutely adorable.
It is pretty cute. And what's fun about this book is that, you know, you have pieces that were written by children who are barely old enough to type their own words. And then you have pieces that, you know, 35-year-olds wrote and had the guts to give to us at a point in their lives when they seriously ought to have known better and were actually trying really too hard to write well.
Well, those are the really brave people in here. For instance, Poe Brownson says, you know, I think this was his attempt at a second novel. Here's just a sentence. Leaves parachuting from delicate limbs, breathing and stretching and swaying in autumn rhythms, dancing as they fall this fall in tune to winds and the gentle breezes from the top of the mountain.
And there is no grammar in that sentence, by the way. That is all one run-on.
Yeah, I don't think there's no verb in there. I don't think. Elizabeth Bernstein, who lives in San Francisco, and she founded and edited the Big Ugly Review, which is a literary magazine online. It's done a lot of short stories and reviewed tons of things. So she has written Birth of a Flower. it is just amazing. And also illustrated it herself, which is really just awful. Birth of a flower, awakening of spring, awakening of a flower. Birth of a sun, melting of water, dripping of ice. Thawing of green, freezing of blue. Parting of clouds, stirring of wind, blowing of air, cooling of skin. Breathing of risk, temptation dawns. Eyes awaken, perceive the wind. Aware of the flower, feel the green, taste the blue. Lick the earth, kiss the sun. Birth of a flower, awakening of spring, taste of life, end of dream, thawing of winter, birth of a soul, birth of a flower, awakening of spring. Oh boy.
That's pretty great. One of the fun things about this book is that we were able to use the original college notebook page that Elizabeth scribbled that poem on, and she drew this picture of herself pregnant with possibilities. It has to be seen to be believed. And we have a lot of other original kind of notes and photos and self-submitted authors, you know, self-portraits from the time where they wrote their melodramatic, incomprehensible stuff.
Exactly. But, you know, there's also quite a number of people went back to childhood, which seems a little bit like cheating, but it's so fun. Here's Katie Crouch, the New York Times bestseller, author of Girls and Trucks, who goes back to her childhood and starts to quote herself from her diary. This was written in November of 1983. It's called Warm and Breezy. This is a very confusing time of life for me. Whoever is reading this, I will try to sort things out for you. To begin with, boys. A couple of boys show interest in me, but no one is fighting for me. There is this girl in my class called Frances Lumpkin, and everybody I know likes her. She's really pretty, careless, and fun to be with. Her mom owns a store called The Dandelion, and it's the most fashionable store in Charleston. She has the best clothes, but couldn't care less, and she has kissed a lot of boys. I've only kissed one, and he was related to me. March 16th, she writes, sunny and warm. I am so happy. I have figured out a way to be popular. The girls are liking me a lot more than they used to. This is my way. Don't ever say something mushy. Never say yes and act careless. She's very interested in this careless idea. Yeah.
Careless. Act careless.
Yeah. Now, help me again. It's Chuck
Palahniuk.
Chuck Palahniuk. This is amazing. Wouldn't you say, this is the most fascinating thing in here for
it's
me.
It's one of the highlights of the whole book. I don't know if you want to set it up or you want me to describe it.
Why don't you?
So Chuck is, I mean, he's a genius humor writer, but this is a completely serious, earnest letter that he wrote to the dictator Pol Pot. When he was, I think, like 10 or 11 or 12.
And didn't he used to write to quite a number of dictators?
Right. He was trying to get them to undo their dictatory ways. But instead of writing as a young boy and trying to embarrass this dictator into stopping being a dictator, he wrote as a kind of in the guise of a narcissistic American movie producer, trying to get him to... anyway, you can kind of take it from there, but it's a very sly, very funny letter to Pol Pot.
And you know, now we're almost running out of time, Julia Scott. So I can't. By the way, author of Drivel, but you know, this is dead serious, but also so clever when he takes this pose writing to Pol Pot that I can't even imagine what Pol Pot did. Was he 10 or? Yes, he was
11 years old.
This is amazing. Julia Scott, who's edited this book, Drivel, Deliciously Bad Writing by Your Favorite Authors.
The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on WNPR. Check out our guest lineup and join the conversation with us and other listeners on Facebook. Just search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to our talented team producer, Jonathan McNichol, and senior producer, Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.